Flying the Laddie, this is AviatorCast, episode 119.
Calling all aviators, you've landed at AviatorCast, the top podcast resource for interviews, refreshers, lessons, training topics, and more. Join weekly and share in our passion for flying things, exploring the rare air through flight. And now, another episode. Pre-flight complete, fuel on board, and flight plan filed. Let's kick the tires and light the fires. Here's your host, Chris Palmer.
Welcome, 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 aviators. You've landed at AviatorCast. My name is Chris Palmer. Aviation is all about community. You think it's all about the airplanes, but that's not the whole story. If you're into aviation and passionate about it, it's about much more than spinning props and lift underneath your wings. While there are plenty of pilots out there that have jobs, a good majority of those pilots have a side gig as part of their passion for aviation. It's a way of giving back to the community that gave to them in the beginning. It takes a village to raise a pilot, and each pilot ends up giving back in some way when the torch is passed to them. So that's exactly what we're going to be doing on today's episode of AviatorCast. We have Justin Seams with us. He is a corporate pilot living in Chicago. He's been working toward aviation for quite a while now, growing his career, and he is flying the Latitude currently. That side gig for Justin, he runs the Pilot to Pilot podcast where he interviews pilots from all walks of life. In a few minutes, we'll have an opportunity to speak with Justin about his career and engage in some hangar talk about aviation. As always, AviatorCast is brought to you by Aviator Training, offering online ground school. Get the free downloadable private pilot action plan, 5 things to do before your first flight lesson. Sign up today at aviatortraining.com. For those of you that are new to AviatorCast, welcome. This is a place where we talk about different aviation topics. Recently, I've been going through and discussing some more safety type topics, more educational type topics. But I also have a whole lot of episodes with just interviews with regular everyday pilots like Justin, who we'll talk to today. We have plenty of backlog of really great content that you can look at. So go ahead and check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, these different locations where you can see that backlog, and you'll see some of those different interviews. So one thing we do before we start each show is I read a review from iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. If I read your review on the show, then you will get a free AviatorCast t-shirt. So what happens if you hear your name on here, I read it, then you'll write me at aviatorcast.com, and we will make sure you get set up with that. So for today, we have a 5-star podcast or a review that comes to us from, La Vida de Playa from USA. He says, inspiring and insightful. Chris and his guests keep the flame burning for all of us with a passion for aviation. Topics vary from flying tips to training and career suggestions to philosophical reflections on learning, teaching, and flying. Listening to these help keep me engaged in flying and thinking about how to be a better pilot. I highly recommend episode 99 because Chris does a fantastic job of describing the mindset to fly professionally. That is, a pilot at any level who flies like a professional. I'm just beginning the journey toward an instrument rating, and this episode put it all into perspective for me. I will make this episode part of my recurring flight review prep. Keep up the great work, Chris. So, La Vida de Playa, thanks for the review. Good luck on your instrument training. That's a really fun one to go through. Definitely challenging, but once you get there, instrument flying is some of the best types of flying that you can do. So put in the work, you'll get there. You know how it is, and that's all part of that professional attitude. Make sure you send me an email, me at aviatorcast.com, and we'll get you lined up with that t-shirt. All right, so we are going to dive right into this interview. We're going to go into hangar talk with Justin Seams. All right, everyone. We are honored to have Justin Seams with us today. Justin, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing? Glad to be on.
Good. Yeah, we finally got you all hooked in here. So had some technical difficulties there. So Justin, tell us a little bit about where you're from, what you're doing in aviation.
All right. So my name is obviously Justin Seams. I am from Charlotte, North Carolina. I went to the Ohio State University, which we are in the news a little bit right now for not so good things, but we'll forget about that. I got my private pilot license at Ohio State, and I also played football there. Then went back to Charlotte, where I did the rest of my training. And now I went from aerial survey to flying freight, and now I have a pretty good charter corporate gig that I have going on, where I'm flying a Citation Latitude, which is a great plane. And I'm also the host of the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Right on, the famous Pilot to Pilot podcast. So, let's rewind back to the very beginning. So those first days when you found out that you kind of had this thing for aviation, that passion, where it was all starting. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I think I'm kind of, I might be a little bit of an anomaly than some of my listeners or your listeners, where I actually never even thought about aviation until I was, 20 years old. My dad was a pilot and my grandpa was a pilot. So you could say that I came from an aviation family, but it never really played a huge influence on my life at that time. We didn't really fly very, very many places. We flew standby every once in a while, but I didn't find a small plane or anything like that. And I was all about sports. I played basketball, I played baseball, I played football nonstop, and I had no time for anything else. So as soon as I kind of got to Ohio State and I realized that maybe the NFL wasn't going to be for me, when I saw that Terrell Pryor was 6'6", 260 pounds and ran a 4.340, I could kind of was like, hey, let me figure something else out. And I went to a couple classes. I went to business classes and I just did not like him whatsoever. I was like, you know what? My grandpa's a pilot. My dad's a pilot. Let me see what I got and let me see if this is for me. And sure enough, I took one flight and I was sold immediately.
So when was that you did that?
I was at Ohio State. I was 20 years old. It would have been, June 10th, 2010. It's weird that I remember the day exactly, it was worth it. Yeah. Well, I tried. Yeah. It actually took me 4 years to get my private pilot license.
Talk about the Ohio State program a little bit.
Talk about football or the training?
Oh, geez. I know you want to talk about football, so just talk about the football first, and then you can go into the training.
I'll mix them both together. So I played at Ohio State, and Coach Tressel was the first coach that I was there with, and he was amazing with it. He gave me all the time I needed. I was able to miss a practice if I really needed to go fly. I was able to miss meetings. He was all about it. He would pull me aside. He'd come talk to me in practice. He'd be like, hey, what kind of plane is that? Or hey, where are you going to fly next? Or hey, when can I come with you? So they were extremely supportive and were 100% with me with going after my dream. But I was not able to really devote all my time to it. So when I devote my time to flying, when I was in practice, I'd be thinking about flying. When I was flying, I'd be thinking about practice and how I wasn't with my guys and with the team. So it was kind of a weird balance that I had to find. And I was only able to get my private pilot license at Ohio State. So I played football there for 4 years. And then it took me 3.5 years to get my private pilot license. Because every single time I got close to taking that check ride, it's when fall camp showed up, or it was winter camp, or something else. Just seemed like something always got in the way. And it also might have been a little bit of me of not necessarily pushing myself as hard as I could have gone, or just thinking about football more and kind of focusing more on, hey, I'm a college kid, that kind of stuff. So I got my private pilot license there, and it was a 141 school, which, as I've talked about on my podcast before, I'm not the biggest fan of 141 schools. I'm more of a Part 61 guy. I like to go at my own pace. I like to go at my own speed. I like to go have fun rather than have to complete this one lesson, or else I can't do anything else. It's like, look, I get it. I'm struggling with stalls. Let me do something else to kind of get my mind off stuff so I can move on. So I went back to Monroe, North Carolina, KEQY, which is the best airport, the best flight school I've ever been to or I've been associated with. And it's just where I got all the rest of my training done. I did all the rest of my training in a year and a half.
Geez, that's pretty quick to get it done in that amount of time.
Yeah, it was,
I think this is one challenge that a lot of people go through, is they have a lot of other things kind of working against them when they're going through training. So as you were going through that process at Ohio State, sorry. Very much a much better school, I'll say that. But when you went to Ohio State and you had to balance all of these things, what was it that like kept the fire alive? Like what, I feel like a lot of people would have fallen off the wagon eventually working through your private for that long. So what was it that kind of pushed you over the edge eventually?
I just knew it's what I wanted to do. You know, I knew that football wasn't going to work out. I knew that I just really didn't like anything else in school. I didn't like business classes. Like I said, I couldn't really see myself getting into sports broadcasting or journalism or anything in that realm of things. So it was just what I had no other options. I was kind of like, flying is what I'm going to do. And it was what I wanted to do. So as soon as I got that in my mind, I was just like, all right, this is what I got to do. I need to devote myself to it, because I could have actually played one more year at Ohio State. I was a 4-year redshirt. So one of the years was redshirt, didn't count against my eligibility. And I actually turned down my fifth year so I could go to Charlotte, go to North Carolina, and I could do my training, because I knew that that's just one more year that I would have lost to my seniority. Because back in that time, I wanted to go majors. There was nothing else I wanted to do. I was all about major airlines and how do I get there. And you have to retire at 65. So I was like, all right, I just lost another year. It's kind of like I'm losing event that could have been $350,000 down the road, you know, that I could lost in that one year. So I figured I might as well go for it.
Gotcha. So, so this transition from being at Ohio State to transitioning just full time to the pilot training, what was that transition like? Like, obviously you had to go look for a school, maybe you just found somewhere near home and kind of lucked out. Like, what was the search like for you during that time?
It was kind of intimidating. There were three schools. There was two at an airport called Monroe, like I talked about earlier, EQY. There's another one at Concord Airport up in North Carolina, just north of Charlotte. And that was ATP. And I knew that I didn't want to spend $80,000 to go from instrument to commercial. It's like, I know I can do this at a fraction of the cost. So I immediately ruled out ATP. And now, I mean, ATP works well for some people, but it just wasn't what I wanted to do. And once again, that's another 141 program. So it would have been going back to what I didn't really like about the training. So it came down to Fly Carolina, which is a flying club where you had to pay monthly dues and you had to fly their airplanes. And it came down to Arrowwood Aviation. And it all really came down to the people. I called, I visited, I went up with some instructors, and I just really did my homework on seeing who was the most genuine, who was not trying to necessarily make money off me, but rather just invest in me to become a pilot. And I found that with Arrowwood Aviation.
That's really interesting. I think that a lot of people forget that they are the boss of their flight training and they get to pick who they employ. You know what I mean? So it's really important to find that person that you fit with, the location you fit with. Not all places are created equal. Like you talked about ATP, you know, there are some people I suggest go to ATP for whatever reason. They have just like the right makeup of things that they want to do to go to ATP. And I don't mean to disparage one school or another, but, just depends on your style and what fits with your life. What's really cool about your story is that you got lined up with a school that was basically doing the same thing that an ATP would do, but they were doing it with probably a much more personal touch, right? Like, what was your experience like while you were there, doing class?
Oh, it was great. It was a small school. So it was just one-on-one with me and my instructor anytime I wanted necessarily. He was busy and he had a bunch of students, but it wasn't too much for him to manage. So I never felt like that I was a number to him or just felt like I was another student. I was able to have a good relationship with him and I was able to work on the things I needed to work on. Maybe outside of class, we could grab lunch. We could watch YouTube videos. He could recommend stuff for me to learn. So I thought that was great. Where ATP, it's kind of like, the instructors are so pushed to go fly. They're so pushed to do this, do that, do this, do that, do that, that they don't have time to kind of mend that relationship and create that relationship. And that's one of the things that's helped me get to where I am today is the relationships that I did create in my flight training. So I'm really thankful for being able to go to that kind of school and create that relationship. And it was great because it was a smaller school. Like I said, it probably had four planes. We had a Champ, we had two 172s, and we had a Piper Arrow. So I got to fly all those, and now they have 20 planes and they're a Cirrus dealer, and they've just like, they're skyrocketing. It's crazy.
Jeez. Well, probably starting with the people in the very beginning, right? The right makeup, yeah. The word of mouth, eventually the word got out that they are just a really great school and everything kind of worked out. So,
without a doubt.
Awesome. So, what was it like after that? Where did your career transition once you went from the training to, I'm assuming, being a commercial pilot now, right? That's kind of the next step. So what was that transition like?
Yeah. So the transition was, it was kind of a stressful, and it kind of brought me back to my recruiting days with football, where I didn't know where I was going to go. It was the first time in a long time where there was just a lot of unknowns. You know, I started my training and doing a flight instructor, but deep down, I knew that that's just something I didn't want to do. There's nothing against flight instructing whatsoever. Like, I just don't think I was meant to be a flight instructor. And I think that's important for everyone to figure out on their own, because not everyone is meant to be a flight instructor, if you know what, if you guys understand what I'm saying. Like, everyone is, there's other ways for you to get your hours and flight instruct. So it's okay if you tell yourself, hey, I don't feel like I would be the best instructor, and you can find other venues for you to go down. Where I looked into aerial survey. It was actually, I got this job, my first job, which was flying aerial survey out of Columbus, Ohio, through my professor at Ohio State. I just messaged him on Facebook. I was like, hey, I have 275 hours. I have my multi-engine commercial. I would really like a job somewhere that's not flight instructing. Do you know of anyone that's hiring? And he goes, hey, talk to this guy that actually graduated my class. He flies for Midwest Aerial Photography. Talk to him, see what he can do. So I texted him immediately. He was like, yo, man, yeah, of course I'll help you out. Here's the chief pilot's phone number. Gave me the phone number. I called him. He's like, yeah, we're actually looking for a pilot. And within, I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks, I was hired. And after, it would have been a month after I got hired, I actually started flying. So it all happened very fast. But that time in between was really stressful, because, you know, it's like, I don't know how I'm going to build those hours. How am I going to get to 1,500 hours to become a regional pilot?
Right. Yeah, I've seen a lot of discussion recently about this rite of passage of being a flight instructor, and like, that's the natural progression after you become a commercial pilot. But my advice has been, and I'm glad that you were in tune with yourself enough to realize this, but my advice was, you know, don't do it unless you're just really passionate about it. If you're not going to help your students and really be into it for them, then you're just wasting their time and money. It's bad customer service. It's kind of being a jerk anyway. So, you know, I really encourage people that want to teach. Otherwise, it kind of hurts the gateway into aviation, because so many people like get that passion, that mentoring from their instructor, and it takes a special person to do that. And, you know, these discussions have kind of gone around, and some people are like, oh, well, you know, you need to be an instructor to be a good pilot. And I really don't think that's the case. So I think you had some awesome insight there to just say, hey, I want to do something else. That's what I'm going to do. And so you went and found something that worked. And it's not that like, you're not good with people. You're obviously good with people. You're doing great things with the podcast and everything, but it's just, you know, that's not what you saw, and you wanted to try something new.
Right. And you know, it's kind of, so, you hit it right. You hit the nail right on the head. If you don't mind me saying real quick, it's just, you have to have a love for it. Because you are the one that is molding this student to become a pilot, to become a professional pilot. And if you don't have the love or dedication to do that, then you might actually turn him away from continuing training, because you might be so focused on yourself and your own training that you're not going to really give him the time that he needs or deserves.
Right. And it's one of those common complaints, right? You get the instructor that's just trying to build time. They're looking toward the airlines. They're just punching the clock. They don't really care. They're just going that direction. And it doesn't help anyone, doesn't help the student, doesn't really help the instructor, doesn't help the flight school. So, you know, I love instructing myself. That's what I am doing, and plan on doing for quite a while. So I think that, I'm kind of pure about it. You know, I want people that really want to do it to be in it. So good. So from there, where are we going? You're doing aerial survey, doing that for a while. Why don't we start with that that part of your career?
Oh boy, where do I start? All right, my first day, I remember this. It was January 15th, 2014. I show up on work 9 a.m. The very first thing they have me do is sweep the entire floor of dead flies. And I'm talking about like thousands of flies were just laid on this floor. And their whole thing was, we're hiring you because you're more than a pilot. Like, what else? Their whole thing in the interview was, what else can you provide this company with? And I was like, well, I'm really good with computers. I can really do blah, 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 like all this stuff. And they're like, all right, here you go. Go mop the floor. And I was like, I thought I got a flying job. But I mean, it's just you got to pay your dues. You know, it's just, and no matter where you go, you have to start from the bottom and work your way up. I was the new guy, so I was the guy that had to mop the floors. And in 2 months, I hired someone else. He was a new guy. He's the one that had to mop the floor. So you just got to work your way up. But after that, I started flying in a 206. We did some missions. We flew all over the country. I did aerial survey in a 310 in Arizona. Did it out near California, the Four Corners area as well. And Colorado, some of us went up to North Dakota, all over the place. But the very first time we went, this is actually where I learned that you can't really trust anyone else's flight planning. You kind of need to always be on the lookout yourself. My very first time I was flying with this guy, and he flew directly into a solid layer of IFR, and it was like -6 degrees at 5,000 feet. Our plane iced up faster than I've never had that experience or ever flown through ice before like that. And we were in an icicle within 10 seconds. We had the defroster on, and I promise you, he could only see that much amount out of his windshield. The whole time we're coming back down to land, we had an IFR flight plan, but like I said earlier, it's just, you need to do your own research. You need to do your own flight planning, because you can't always count on someone in aviation. But we came down, everything worked out, and we landed at some really small field in Indiana that has like the world's largest rocking chair or world's largest wind chime, like the most random thing you could ever imagine in your life. And we landed there, and it was really a wake up call. It kind of showed me what the next 9 months of my life was going to be like, to be honest with you. So pretty funny.
So that was the very beginning of your job there, where you experienced that icing.
Yeah, that was the very first flight I have ever been on with that company.
Jeez. So what more did you learn from that particular experience of doing aerial survey? Like, I'll probably ask this question in each phase, but how did you grow as a pilot during that process? Like, saying that you do your own flight planning is very helpful. What else?
All right. So I learned that that's where I kind of learned that maintenance is the most important aspect in aviation. Whenever I got a job after that, I always was worried about, what's your maintenance like? How do you take care of the airplanes? We were flying 206s that were old, over TBO, like way over TBO, but I had 400 hours. I wasn't really like, I didn't know what that meant. Like, I knew what that meant, but at the same time, I didn't know what that meant. Like, I didn't know how serious that was. And we were feeding oil into this thing, and just maintenance wasn't the best. And this is the second thing that I've had happen with when I was with that company. It's kind of lucky that I'm able to talk with you today, because we actually were flying back from Washington, D.C. We had an aerial survey mission in the middle of the CFRA, and we're flying like low altitude, close to restricted areas all over the place. But we're flying back home 4,500 feet, and our engine seized up over West Virginia. And we had, I think from when we reminisced and we talked about it, we had probably 30 seconds in the air before we landed on a mountain. And we actually landed on a mountaintop of West Virginia. I don't think I sent you that picture. I should have sent you that picture, because I have it. But we landed on a mountaintop, and we landed uphill next to two huge pressurized oil tanks. We probably landed 25 feet away from them. If the ground wasn't wet, if we didn't have the best landing of our lives, if that field that was owned by an oil company and just filled in, it was a retention pond, they just filled it in with sand or grass or whatever crappy thing they filled it in with 2 months before we went there. So it was wild. But yeah, lost our engine in a single engine 206, landed on a mountain. And the scariest part was actually the people that saved us. They were like wild West Virginia men that have never bought meat at a grocery store. As soon as we walked in their door, they had a deer on the table. They're chopping up the deer. I kid you not, for meat. That was their meat for the next month, was the deer that they were chopping up. It was wild.
You need to sell your story to Stephen King or something.
Like, just, seriously,
I mean, the kind mountain of a scary man, event to begin with, to go through an accident, or I don't know what they deemed it, maybe an incident, but then to like have it go into the scary woods. You told me about that at Oshkosh. Yeah. Pretty funny story.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was legit more worried about.
Did you learn anything else, like, from the accident process? Like, and by the way, sorry for the delay here. We're gonna interrupt each other now and again. But did you learn anything else from the accident process? Like, I know you talked about maintenance. You feel like you reacted well to the situation when you went through it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I'll start out with how we reacted, because how we reacted was honestly the only reason why we're still alive. Like I said, there was only 25, 30 seconds that we had before we actually landed on the mountain. And it was the first 2 seconds we were like, oh my gosh, this actually happened. Like, we were just like in shock and disbelief. We're like, what do we do? How did this happen to us? I can't believe this actually happened. And then right after that, I mean, training kicks in. You reach for the fuel. You make sure the fuel is right. You make sure you're at your right speed that you need to be at. You make sure your mixture's right. You make sure everything's right. You know, you're talking on guard. You're squawking what you need to squawk, and you're figuring out where you're going to land. And we kind of got, we're getting closer to where we didn't know where we were going to land right away. So we're coming on down, and all around us were just trees, mountaintops, and it was in a lot of snow, so it was hard to see stuff. And it just didn't look good. So we started freaking out a little bit more. And then we were just flying the plane on in, and we saw the perfect spot. It was like it was made for us. It's like God laid it out there for us to land in. And we just turned on in, and we went down, and we landed that bad boy right where we needed to land it. And one other thing I learned was that the FAA is not always out to get you. They were so nice with us. They actually didn't even investigate us. They didn't look at it as an accident, didn't look at it as an incident. They just said, you guys legit did the only thing you could have done to land. Like, we're not investigating you guys. Like, this is amazing. Congratulations. They specifically told us that this is going to be a great story for when you go interview at the airlines.
Yeah, that's one really nice thing about these days, is it seems like the FAA has this much better attitude about just working with the pilots. I don't know why it was anything other than that, like, ever, because it just makes sense.
Beats
you know,
me.
If from their perspective, you want compliance and you want to increase safety, or rather keep safety, even just keep it at the level it's at now, then work with us. You know, let's work together. Let's not have this like, I don't know, smoke and mirrors game where we're hiding from them, or they're trying to come out and get us. So that's cool to hear that that they treated you guys that way. I've only been in a couple situations that were scary, but I can't imagine what it's like to actually have an engine out and actually have to put it down. So, you know, it's a testament to your skill and the people that trained you and everything.
Yeah, it was wild. I would definitely not recommend that for happen to anyone. So.
Yeah, let's not try that on purpose, okay, everyone?
Yeah, no, don't do that. Yeah.
That's a PSA here.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into the PC-12. So is that next in your career? Was that what you were doing next?
That was next. So after that happened in Aero Survey, I went on and flew the 310. I flew an Aero Commander, and I got enough multi-time where I felt comfortable of going to a single pilot, single engine IFR company. Because obviously when you're building time, it is about the number that you have, but it's also about the quality of time that you have. So I knew that multi-engine time was going to be important. So as soon as I hit a number where I felt comfortable, which was right around 600 hours, I knew that I could go on and further my career with something else. And looking at doing aerial survey, a lot of guys would stay there and they would wait until 1500 to go to the regionals. But it was at that time that I started really developing a love for general aviation and just going to different FBOs and getting my own fuel and talking to people, getting crappy crew cars to go get great $100 hamburgers all over the country. So I kind of started realizing, I was like, I don't know if I want to be a regional pilot. And this was before regional airlines were paying $50,000 or $40,000 signing bonuses. This was before you had the retention that they have now or the flow program. So it just was not a good job to have. So I said I wasn't going to do that, and I was going to aim for the corporate job that I had in mind. And I kind of had this corporate job in mind from Columbus, Ohio, and from college. And I just went after it. And I knew that I needed to get some single pilot, not single pilot, but I knew I needed to get some IFR time if I wanted to go there. So I thought, why not go single pilot IFR and fly for a company that had my dream plane, which what you said was the PC-12.
Right on. So you you started going in the PC-12. You did that for quite a while, right? How many hours did you build in it? What type of flying did you do? What was your regular everyday schedule like?
So I started in the Caravan, and I was in the Caravan for about 9 months. And then after that, I was in the PC-12, and I was in the PC-12 for about a year and 3 months. And total time there was just over 2 years, probably two years and 4 months. And I got just under 2,000 hours in that time. There's some months I was turning out 140 hours, 130 hours, and there's other months that only we'd only fly probably 40 or 50 or 30. Some of the winter months were slower, but our schedule was 10 days on, 4 days off. We were on call 24/7. So a lot of times I'd be sitting at home, number one on call. I had to be within 15 minutes of the airport in a place called Kittern, Ohio, which no one has ever heard of for a good reason. It's surrounded by the only traffic that I had driving to my airport where we flew out of was Amish buggies. So I legit would be screaming down the road trying to get to work on time, and there'd be Amish buggies all over the place that you're swerving in and out of and trying not to hit. So it was wild. It's like a flashback in time. But we went there. So an average day, if I was number one, I'd wake up maybe at like 9 a.m. and I get called out by 11 a.m. and then go fly. And it would range from anywhere from a 6 hour trip flying to, I think the most I ever flew was 13 hours in one day. And most of that was 135 time plan completion, as they would call it. And then the rest was just 91 repositioning or 91 flying to go pick up whatever I needed to do or set up for the next day.
And you had a pretty sweet looking PC-12. Did you send me a picture of it?
No. I don't think
so,
I did.
So tell us about it.
We had Stars and Stripes PC-12. It was American flag, and it's one of my favorite paint jobs I've ever seen on any airplane. So it was a lot of fun flying it. Every July 4th, I'd always post a picture of it just because it's the most patriotic. I mean, I was flying the flag essentially, which it was funny because it's a Swiss made airplane. So it's a Swiss plane flying the American flag. But yeah, it was a good plane. Pilatus is my second favorite plane I've ever flown, but that's just because I just started flying jets. So I'm in the shiny jet syndrome right now where every jet's the best.
Yeah, man. Yeah, that's a different lifestyle for sure. So from like a nerdy pilot perspective, what makes the PC-12 such a fun airplane to fly?
Just its capabilities. I mean, we were taking tons of weight, and we were taking all our takeoff. Our ground roll was 800 feet, 700 feet, and we're climbing out at like 2,000 feet a minute, and we're fully loaded. We can go in and out of any airport that a Caravan could go in and out of, that a King Air could go to, I mean, even more than a King Air. And we could do everything you could ever want. The plane was unbelievable. And the speeds that you can fly on a single engine turboprop for that plane, it was just wild. Like, we were legit right on par with some of the King Airs that are out there. So we could go from, I think the farthest distance I ever covered was Trenton, New Jersey to Nashville to Laredo, Texas, to Cuatro, Mexico, and then back to Laredo, Texas. And I did that in under a 14-hour duty day with like 7 hour. No, I had SIC with me, so I did it in 9 hours, like 58 minutes of flying.
That is crazy. Talk about a long
day. It was wild.
Holy cow.
Yeah, talk about a long day in a small-ish cockpit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they're smallish cockpit. Yeah, you and your jet now.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like that airplane is a really good workhorse. I've never flown one myself. Of course, they keep upgrading it, and it keeps improving as time goes on, which I guess is the case for pretty much any platform. But yeah, it seemed like that was a really cool gig where you got to see a lot of different airports. You got to see a lot of different different areas of the country. And I guess that would be in my next question is, like, what did you learn about the variety of aviation through just being able to see the different places you went to? Because, you know, eventually eventually I kind of wonder if it all blurs together a little bit, like if it ends up just becoming numbers to you from an IFR perspective, or like if you're in those places, if you enjoy it there, if you, you know, if you like the whole horse and buggy thing you get, or what was that like? Was that a cool way to build your time toward your dream job?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of why I chose that route, if that makes sense. Because in aviation, that's what you're doing. You're traveling from point A to point B. You know, you're going from this place to that place. You're learning new things. You're figuring out, you're going to new, just like I said, new places. So that's why I chose aerial survey. It kind of got me the groundwork on of getting used to traveling like that. And even through freight, it furthered that, but it did get kind of a point where it's like, oh, here's another crappy little airport, or here's another Bravo. But there's a lot of times where it was like, oh my gosh, I'm flying into Salt Lake City. Like, this is so cool. Look at those mountains. Or, oh my gosh, there's Colorado Springs. Like, this is awesome. It's like, oh, I get to go to California for the first time. Like, it's like, this is so cool. I'm doing it in a PC-12 and I'm flying from Ohio nonstop or something like that. It's like, this is unbelievable. So it was a mix, I'd say, but I'd say most of it was probably like, oh, this is sweet. This is a lot of fun. Like the other day I was up in Bozeman, Montana, no, Anaconda, Montana. And it was like the cool, whoever thought they'd go to Anaconda, Montana? I mean, I didn't even know it existed. I didn't know it was a real place. I thought they were joking when I got my brief, but it was awesome. I went there, and as soon as we land there, there's a guy who builds homemade RC planes, RC plane kits. And he was like, this was his first flight, and we were there to talk with him. We watched him fly. We watched him crash it on landing and watch him cry about how he has to build another one. So it's like, where else can you do that other in aviation or other in general aviation? Because when you're an airline pilot, you're just, you know, you're clocking in, you're going from point A to point B, clocking out, going to a hotel, going to, you know, it's just, I like the variety of meeting new people, like the RC plane guy, or running into you. Maybe we'll come up to Homer one time and come run into you. Like, you just never know where you could go.
Yeah, I think that's honestly, it's one of the coolest parts of aviation, is just to see different places, have different experiences. I get a lot of people that talk to me and they're like, hey, yeah, I totally want to fly in Alaska, and it's got to be amazing to fly there. And yeah, it's great, but it's just one place. You know, I've had amazing aviation experiences everywhere I go, like Wisconsin, as stupid as it sounds, like South Dakota, North Carolina has a great aviation community. Georgia, Florida, like it's endless. Wherever I go, there's like this unique, cool community of aviation that you can plug into and see new and different things. And it's just, when you add that variety to it and you add kind of the adventure and the exploring and the aviation and the curiosity for where you are and just appreciating where you are instead of just dreaming of where you're going to go, then I feel like it just kind of makes the journey worth it. So cool. So now I feel like we're kind of summarizing your PC-12 stuff a little bit too much. So maybe we can go back to it, but now you're going to kind of be moving into your dream job. So I know we're not going to divulge like your employer or anything like that, but where were things moving next after the PC-12?
Well, there's always one goal. I knew where I wanted to go after the freight job. I knew the company, I was hoping the plane that I'd get, which I did actually get it, but it was just one goal. I knew I had an hour mark to reach. And it's funny because, you know, there's always these hour marks you got to reach. You got to get 250 to take your commercial check ride, depending on what kind of flight school you're at. You have to get 1500 hours or 1000 or 1200 be hired by a regional. And then even after that, for me, it was like, all right, now I need 2500 hours to get hired by this job. I need to make sure I have whatever multi, whatever nighttime, whatever, all that other kind of thing. You're still ticking boxes. So it was me just ticking my boxes, waiting until I could get to the hour mark that I needed. And as soon as I hit it, I submitted my application right away. And it got me to fly the Citation Latitude, which I talked about before, which is a relatively new airplane that's been out by Cessna for about 2 years. My company has quite a bit of them. I think they have like 47 with plans of like 140. So it's going to be a complete workhorse for our company. And it's a great plane. I mean, I loved flying freight. I did. It was just a time builder, which, I mean, a lot of people do use freight as that. I mean, maybe a lot of people do go back and fly freight when their career is done. But for me at that time, it served as a time builder, and it really did build me into the pilot that I did become today. And I think that I don't know if I would be able to get the job that I had now without that experience.
Yeah, it seems like every little step we take, there's a new step that they want you to get to, whether that's insurance or the company you're going to work for. It's like the training is never ending. I kind of wonder if there are any guys out there that actually just get to do whatever they want to do. It's like, oh yeah, you're this guy. You've got this amount of time. You get to do whatever you want. It doesn't seem like those people exist. There's always a little caveat to what they have to do to be qualified for that airplane or whatever. So it's kind of a funny song and dance. So tell us about the Latitude again, kind of from a nerdy perspective. What's it like to fly? What kind of avionics does it have? Tell us a little bit about the experience just flying the airplane.
That's great. So we have G5000. So it's the newest and greatest from Garmin. It's unbelievable. It's like having four huge touchscreens on the plane. I mean, we have synthetic vision. We have XM weather. We have onboard weather. We have, let's see, we have three big MFDs. And then we have four what we call GTCs. And we control everything with those GTCs. They're Garmin touch controllers. And every one serves a different function. We can get PDCS, where we can get clearances on the ground. We can just plug those clearances straight into our flight plan and go from where we need to go. We have it's just amazing what we can do in that bad boy. I mean, the engines and the thrust that we have 6,000 pounds of just under 6,000 pounds of thrust per side. So, I mean, we're usually taking off, I don't know, if we're heavy, it'll be 3,000, which is a decent amount. But when we're coming into land, I mean, we can be fully stopped and 1,500 feet if we have to. Our rev speed on landing, I think the lowest I've seen it so far is 95, which is unbelievable for a jet that weighs 31,000 pounds at takeoff. So it's crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. How much further are you stretching your legs these days in terms of distance? So before you were kind of staying within the U.S., are you going international now?
We go to
Mexico before. We probably did Canada as well.
Yeah. It's pretty much the same way that I did the same places. I mean, we'll go to different places in those countries, but we'll go to Canada. I haven't been to Mexico here yet. I haven't been to the Caribbean, but we'll go to the islands. Usually in the wintertime, we start taking people down to the islands. We'll go to like Costa Rica area and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, that kind of opens up new opportunities, I guess. Do you have a favorite place that you've flown? I know you talked about, what was it? Was it Anaconda,
Montana? Anaconda, Montana. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd say right
what
now.
What other places have you liked?
Haley, Idaho was a lot of fun. It was just a really cool airport. I've never been to Idaho before, and it's just surrounded by the mountains. When you do the RNAV in there, it's like a tailored RNAV almost, where you're kind of just like following. It's not an RMP approach, but it's definitely not a straight in by any means. There's mountains all over the place. We've done the approach into Aspen, but we weren't allowed to land there because the winds were more than our company would let us, the tailwind. So we're coming down on final, and they gave us the winds again, and it turns out we had a 15-knot tailwind, so we had to go power set, flaps two, go around, that whole deal. And we went to Rifle, Colorado, which Rifle is another awesome airport. And just, I'd say just the mountain airports. I love being around the mountains. I love just the scenery that's out there. And it's really sad with all the fires and stuff. So it's not the best time this year to be going there. But it's been, I'd say the mountains. Oh, and Napa. We went to Napa, California. That was fun.
Yeah, let's see. I've been to the small Napa airport. I don't know if it's the same one.
It's probably the same one.
I don't know how many airports are there.
Yeah, I think it's just the one.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when we went there, it was covered. There was a fire still that was probably about 30 miles away. And it looked like we're on Mars. I have pictures on my Instagram where it was as red as could be. There was so much cloud and soot and ash that we had to brush off the whole plane. It's like it snowed overnight. It was just covered in ash.
Yeah, it's crazy. When I was there, it seems like you could... Sure, there are many war stories to tell for each airport, probably on a weekly basis. But when I was there, I saw some guy... It was a runway incursion. I saw a guy pull out right in front of another airplane on short final, and it was pretty close. Anyway, that's my memory of Napa.
It's busy, so that makes sense.
I was trying to look up Haley. Yeah, Haley.
Yeah, look it up. It's cool.
So is that Sun Valley? Is that considered Sun Valley?
Yeah, it should be K-Sun, yeah. Yep, it would have been Sun Valley.
There's a really good like cowboy saloon there that I used to go to with my dad.
Oh, no way. They told me that it was a great place for us to overnight.
Yeah, they have like potatoes the size of footballs. You know what a football is like. So seriously, it's a huge potato. So
nice.
It's a really good place to find it. Yeah, man. All right. So it sounds like your career is going great with the new airplane, with the new company. Tell us a little bit about the Pilot to Pilot podcast and why you started it and what you've learned from that.
So yeah, it's actually kind of a funny story. So when I was doing freight, we're actually kind of slow when I first started, and I spent a lot of my time just playing video games, and I really wasn't doing anything productive. I was playing Battlefield, Call of Duty, FIFA, just sitting there like a couch potato. And my wife comes up to me and she's like, look, I know that you fly and you're busy when you fly, but like these 5, 6, 7 days that you're sitting at home, it's like you need to contribute to society in some way. It's like you have all this free time. What are you doing with your life? And she was really pushing me to start a podcast and to start an Instagram page. And I wasn't against it necessarily, but I was like, who wants to listen to me talk? Like, I hate the sound of my voice. Like, it's just, I don't think anyone's going to want to listen to me talk. I don't think I have anything to say that anyone wants to hear. And I put it off for about 6 months, and I just was thinking about it. And eventually I was like, all right, I'll do it. And I hooked up with Patrick Pierce, who runs Instaplane, which is one of my favorite accounts. He's a great guy. Instaplane, I think they have like almost like 100,000+ followers. And I only had like 500. And he was like, yeah, man, I'd love to help you out. So right then and there, I started realizing that the aviation community is something special. Like this guy with so many followers, he's only 16, by the way. And I was like 20, 27, and I was crazy, begging for his help. Yeah. But it's like he realized that I was trying to do something that was going to, that I necessarily wasn't just asking for him for a shout out for my page, but I was trying to create some kind of content that would maybe help someone out in the future. And he was all about it. And I'm still very thankful for that. So I did my first episode with him, and it just kind of went from there. After that, I interviewed, I think Rochelle was the next one, and she got me another, kept going. And from there, just kept on going and going. And it's been a lot of fun. I mean, I'm kind of sad that I didn't start it up right away when my wife gave me the idea now, because I missed out on 6 months. Like, who knows where it could be if I didn't do it right, if I would have done it for all those 6 months.
It's kind of a bummer that our wives have to be so responsible and make us do,
I know, right?
Adult things.
Exactly.
That's pretty awesome. So how many episodes have you got so far, and what type of people do you interview? It seems to me, I mean, I kind of already know the answer, is you basically just interview anybody that's like into aviation. Oh, it's pretty awesome.
Honestly. Yeah. I mean, I've done, I think it was 40 episodes, and I was actually shocked. I didn't include it, and I should have, but when I was recording, so I record every, I don't have anything pre-recorded whatsoever. So every episode's brand new. Like I recut the intro, I recut everything every single time. And I was like, gotcha. Wait, what episode am I on? And I went back and listened, and I was like, that last one was 39. So this is 40. And for about 5 minutes, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm at 40 episodes. Like, how has this happened? Like, why are people still listening? Like, I don't understand this type deal. Like, I was just in shock that people listen to the podcast, and I have 40 of these. So it was crazy. But like you said, I don't look at Instagram followers whatsoever. I look at a story as a whole when I'm choosing people. I just want to know what you've gone through, and want to know that you're a sincere and good person, and that you love aviation just like everyone else does. Because I truly believe that everyone has a story to tell, and everyone's story can help someone maybe start flying. Because everyone relates to people in different ways. I mean, you know that. Like, some people can relate to each other, and some people are like, I don't like that guy. So you never know who you have on that podcast that will be able to touch or help one person join this amazing industry that we have. So who am I to say that you only have 6 followers on Instagram, you don't have a good enough story to tell, when in all actuality, he might have the best and most inspiring story to tell. So when it comes down to it, it nothing to do with Instagram, nothing to do with followers, just has to do with who you are as a person and what – just how our conversation goes. So, I mean, if anyone's listening to this, they want to come to the podcast, send me a message and we'll make it work. Like, that's how it works with me.
Right on, man. Yeah. It seems like there are a lot of people out there that are kind of diamonds in the rough. They may not have all those followers, but they do have a unique story. And I found that some of my best podcasts, you would think that they'd be like the people from NASA or this fighter pilot or that person, but it's like the dude that just became a private pilot. And he has like this cool perspective of what it was like and what he went through. And that always, I don't know, there's so many different angles to it that just seem to help out. So have you, And I'm sure you do. Have you received any good feedback, like people telling you, hey, this, you know, this helped me out a ton, or helped me get into flying? Have you received anything like that so far?
Yeah, I have. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I kept doing it, because I kept on getting these messages from people. They're like, hey, I'm 16 years old. Like, I love your podcast. And I'm sitting here reading. I'm like, oh my gosh, still, I'm like, people listen to this. Like, this is amazing. But he's like, hey man, I love your podcast. Like, it's made me want to start flying. Like, and then we get into a conversation, we start talking about it. And it's really cool, because then I can kind of give back, because I had so many people help me out when I was training that now I feel like it's my duty and it's my turn to help and give back as well. So now I get to invest in other people that are coming up through flight training. And it's been actually really cool, because it's been anywhere from 16-year-olds, or most recently someone was 35 in the 40 age, somewhere in that age range. And he was like, hey man, like your podcast has just gave me the bug so bad that I'm actually going to quit my job and I'm going to pursue training full time. And it's just like, first of all, it's like, oh my gosh, that's terrifying. Like, I'm nervous for you, but it's like, that's so cool. Yeah. that he got the bug from just me talking with someone on a podcast. Like, I've never met this guy. I've never talked to him in person whatsoever. The only interaction we've ever had is on Instagram direct messages. And who knows how long his direct messages are sitting there, because I'm terrible at responding to DMs. But it's amazing. It's the feedback and the community and just the people that are in aviation are just unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, I kind of open up each show with a bit of a monologue. And so at the very beginning, like I usually just come up with the idea super quick. But at the very beginning, it was like, it takes a village to raise a pilot. And eventually, it seems like if you're doing things right and you're staying in it and staying passionate about it, then you got to give back at some point. So I like that in our generation, people are finding unique ways to give back, whether that's like you with your inspiring podcast, or if it's with someone else that has an Instagram channel and they're just showing their unique perspective, or YouTube or whatever it is. It's just really cool that we have all of these different places where prospective pilots can come and look at examples of people that are just like them, that are, you know, just several steps ahead of them. It's not like they're anything special, but they've done the work and they've worked toward it. And these are the things they're doing and get to do. Sometimes I'm sure you feel this way too. Sometimes I look back, or rather kind of step back from my life right now. It's like, I get to live where I want to live. I get to instruct. I get to do like teach aviation and do all these amazing adventures and things. It's like, how did I get myself here? You know, obviously it was intentional at some point, but it's just really cool to see that. And then like feel that responsibility or that need to help someone out, like just mentoring. So I really like that you've been doing that with your podcast. So kind of to wrap up the show here, since I don't want to take too much of your time, but
you're good, man. I got nothing going on.
Spiel, or if you're talking directly to someone, why should they get in aviation? What do they need to do? What would be your words of inspiration?
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, right now, it's very easy for me to tell you to get in aviation. Just all I can tell you to do is look up how much you can make. I mean, that's unfortunately, which I say unfortunately, because in aviation, if you're driven by money, you're not going to be fulfilled. You're always going to be chasing that money, and you're never going to be able to be like, oh my gosh, I'm flying. I'm doing something that no one ever thought that we could even do at one point in life. So I would say that just this is the best time to get in aviation. Everyone's hiring. I think Boeing estimated that we need 630,000 pilots in the next decade or two decades. So it's like, go for it now. Just there's nothing else that you can do. You need to go to your flight school right now. You need to go do your first flight lesson and be like, hey, I actually do like this. And you need to go after it. It's just go for it. And then going on for advice in that, I would say that there's two main things that I would say is that don't make excuses and don't be lazy. Those are, because no one wants to listen to your excuses. You are the only person that can hold you back or that can help you get into this career. So you need to go after it as hard as you can. And don't say, I don't have the money. Don't say that a regional is not going to hire me. Don't say that I can't be this kind of pilot. It's like, just go for it. Just work and see where you get. If you can work as hard as you can and get stuff done as quick and as safe and just just get it all done as soon as you can, you're going to find yourself in an amazing career, amazing job. And what's great about aviation is that there's not one job that you should aim for. Like I said, I wanted to be an airline pilot, but I'm now flying corporate. And then if I look back at myself, I don't think my 16-year-old or 19-year-old self would be disappointed in where I am today. Like, I've learned that there's so many cool jobs in aviation. Like, what you're doing is unbelievable. The flight school that you have going on in Alaska, the videos that you're creating and the impact that you're making is just unbelievable. But we also have people, like, what I've learned in the podcast is that you can do so much stuff to build your time. I was talking with Carlsbad Pilot. Well, Carl might be a bad pilot. So I don't know. I've never flown with him. But yeah, I was talking with Justin, and he flew single engine plane out like 100 miles out of the ocean, and he was spotting fish for fishermen. He would just go, I don't know what exactly how he did it, but he'd like shoot a laser down and they would see where the fish were and they'd go fish. It's like there's so many flying jobs that you can do that are just unbelievable. I mean, you look at Trent Palmer, you look at people flying in Alaska, the Flying Cowboys, just all those guys. Or you look at flying, I think it's Tropic Airways, they fly in New York and they fly in Florida and they fly caravans on floats. It's like, who doesn't want to fly caravans on floats? Right. Like, that sounds amazing. There are just so many cool things that you can do. And that is, would really encourage people not to be worried about money, because like I said earlier, money is not going to fulfill you in this career. It's a driving force, which is unfortunate, and it's always going to be that way. But if you can look, take everything into account, the job that you have, the time you get to spend with your family at home, and just the what you get to do, what you get to fly, who you get to interact with. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I just encourage them to take in the whole picture when they're looking for a job.
Great advice. I really liked your advice about don't make excuses and put in the effort. I think that's something that every single prospective pilot can learn. And then, man, just connect with others out there in the industry that you see and just ask them. You know, I know that you're totally open to people just writing you and being like, hey, what do you think about this? Or what school do you think I should go to? Like, we're totally available. That's just the way it is. We're social on social media. We're not just spewing stuff out.
Go figure. Yeah.
Trying to get popular or something.
Yeah. Not at all.
So, all right, man. Well, it's been a real pleasure to hang out with you for a few minutes. Really enjoyed hanging out with you at Oshkosh as well. Hope we get to do it next year.
For sure.
And yeah, keep up the good work and we'll talk soon.
I appreciate it. Definitely, man. Appreciate you having me on.
All right, buddy.
See ya.
Yeah, no problem. Talk soon.
Join us next week for another exciting topic or interview with a great guest. All AviatorCast resources can be found at aviatorcast.com. Subscribe to AviatorCast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, YouTube, and other podcast services. Did you enjoy the show? Review AviatorCast on iTunes or similar service. If your review is aired on the show, we'll send you an official AviatorCast t-shirt. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Write AviatorCast at me@aviatorcast.com to introduce yourself or to ask any questions you may have about aviation. Now, for the final release clearance, back to Chris Palmer.
All right, everybody. It is it's really awesome to have Justin on the show and to get to talk to him a little bit about his career and what he's been able to do. It just goes to show that if you put in the effort and you come up with a plan and you're passionate about it, eventually you're going to get to a place where you're in a career and you are you're doing something you love. So I know that every single day I talk to people that are excited about becoming pilots. You know, they're trying to go through that process of figuring out how to put the pieces together with time and money and family and all these other things that are challenges in one way or another. But like Justin said, you just got to put in the effort and you can't make excuses and you've got to find a way to build this plan for yourself. So again, a huge thanks to Justin. You guys need to go check him out, the Pilot to Pilot podcast. He's also on Instagram, Pilot2Pilot, really easy to find. And also, he is online at pilot2pilothq, I believe it is, .com or .net. I forget which one it is, but you can find his link in his Instagram. So it'll be pretty easy to find him there. So appreciate you guys coming and hope you'll join me next time. Until then, throttle on.